You're listening to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm DJ EJ with my co-host Habanero. We've got David Morris of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. David, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you landed at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and what you're all about.
I came of age in the early 60s. And so I was informed by Sputnik, civil rights, the decolonization movement, and I connected with this group called the Institute for Policy Studies when I was a senior at college. And they were an organization that was started by three disaffected people from the John F. Kennedy administration and set up an institute in Washington, D.C. And it was a time where fresh thinking was absolutely necessary. And they set up that institute. And that's how I ended up in Washington, D.C. And I was there, you know, at an interesting global moment. But also, the District of Columbia was gaining home rule. The District of Columbia at one point in the early 19th century actually was a city. And then when blacks were moving north after the Civil War and threatened to become a majority in the District of Columbia, whites gave up their citizenship, and it became a department of the federal government for 100 years. And then in the late 1960s, people could vote for the school board. And then in the early 1970s, they could vote for mayor and city council. And that's when I arrived in Washington, D.C. So there was a sense that it was moving towards statehood from being a colony, and therefore those of us who were politically oriented were suddenly in the midst of that type of, if you will, decolonization movement. And it's in that period that several of us decided to start an organization that was focused on cities. One other aspect of my coming of age is that the Institute for Policy Studies, when Salvador Allende was elected president of Chile in 1970, they sent me down there to find out how you do it, how you speak truth to power and get elected. And once elected as a minority government, how do you get things done? And while I was there, I suddenly was in a country that had a population the size of New York City and a gross national product or gross domestic product that was smaller than the budget of New York City. And in any way that you wanted to measure it, except for natural resources, New York City had more resources. And there was a moment where I saw that in Chile, they were trying desperately to make a revolution, a peaceful revolution. They were peaceably elected. And I came back at that moment and New York City was declaring itself bankrupt and giving up power to three bankers called the Big Mac. And so it was clearly a poverty of will and imagination on the part of New York City. And so New York City ceded their authority, and Chile did not, but they were overthrown by people who lived in Washington, D.C. And so I, at that point, thought maybe municipal political parties would be a way that we might want to focus our attention in the United States. And we might want to do that because cities have a significant amount of authority, often untapped. And out of that came the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
One of the things that really struck me in what you said was the ability or the power of the municipality that they may not realize that they have. I'm interested in ways that cities can leverage their authority and their assets. And that's something that you obviously have experience with. So I'd be interested in hearing a little bit more about that concept you have or ILSR has related to that municipal authority.
At the Institute, we talk about the arc of community, ARC. And by that, we mean the authority, that's the A, responsibilities, the R, and C means capacity. Authority is the right to make the rules. Responsibility is the willingness to accept responsibility for those less well off, for future generations. And capacity is the ability to generate wealth, that is to produce things internal to the city. And those are a trinity of things that are, to me, essential. And that is the meaning of local self-reliance. When we started the Institute, we found the The kindred spirits were conservatives, and it was because conservatives loved the idea of community. They loved the idea of mutual aid. They loved the idea of self-help. What they didn't like was the exercise of collective authority to make rules, especially if those rules related to the economy. Whereas liberals or progressives didn't like cities, didn't like localism, were appalled by what had happened in the name of states' rights, thought that communities were parochial and xenophobic. And so, you know, we found our, if not allies, at least supporters in newspapers and the like, initially were conservatives until they realized that we were talking about the rules. And at the Institute, one of our slogans is, we make the rules and the rules make us. The rules that we make channel scientific expertise and human genius and finance and capital in certain directions. And so the rules we've made have in fact made us the kind of place that we are today. So when we talk about authority, one thing I always like to talk about antecedents. And at the end of the 19th century, cities were corrupt, cities were inefficient, and cities were mere appendages of the states. That's what the Supreme Court said they were, and that's what they were. They had virtually no authority. And the private sector essentially ran cities and paid off local politicians. And there arose a movement at that time, late 1890s, early 20th century, called the Municipal Home Rule Movement. And it was a movement to clean up cities, to make them more efficient, and also for cities to exercise, to own basic infrastructure. And so out of the Municipal Home Rule Movement came legislation at the state level that said that states could not, at a whim, intervene in cities. And number two came out of that was city ownership of utilities.
Who was driving that movement? Where was it coming from? If there were two to three things that made people go, we have to do this, what were they?
Yeah, well, what was driving it was the monopoly of private capital on streetcars in terms of the wages, the prices that were set for streetcars. Electric utilities that came in were appallingly inefficient and high cost. And often in cities, you might have a dozen different electric utilities, you know, all privately owned. There were the water departments were privately owned, natural gas, which was used as heating, was privately owned, and so there was, you know, an enormous amount of corruption, and so the people did, you know, rise up around that. The other thing is that in the late 19th century, you had the socialist movement, which was focused on cities, and you had the populist movement that was focused on rural areas, and both of them were primarily interested in public ownership and primarily interested in regaining authority. The populist movement were farmers essentially rebelling against places like Minneapolis, which were the bankers and the places that took their wheat and processed it into flour. And in terms of socialist program, you know, they would like socialism in the federal government, but they were primarily focused on it in cities at the turn of the century. And it was called at that time sewer socialism, S-E-W-E-R. It was essentially the ownership by the people of the basic infrastructure of the city, because it didn't run well under private ownership.
It feels like there's some analogous situations to today. People are frustrated about the same thing. In a lot of cases, it's the corporate domination of society and oppressive rules that people feel in both rural and urban areas. I think people interpret them differently and may have different agendas for them. Is that potentially true?
Yes. Well, it's perfectly true. Although here we're talking now about global corporations, and at that point we were talking about national corporations, which were just beginning as national corporations. No, we are. And we've created rules in the last 40 or 50 years in this country that really have unleashed the power of global corporations and national corporations. You know, the rules that we had, it's, and when you look out there and you say, oh my God, what's going on? Oh my God, what's going on? Well, 50 years ago, it was illegal. You know, and people don't know.
Let's give an example.
Corporations are putting far more money in buying back their stock than they are in research and development or anything that remotely we would accept as the role of corporations and what they should do for the public good. Even though they are interested in private profit, there is no reason why they shouldn't be using their investment capital to increase their productivity. You know, buying your shares back doesn't increase productivity. up until the early 1980s, that was illegal. And in the 1990s, the federal government passed, you know, new rules that essentially nationalized the banking system. That is, you had state banks and you had federal banks, and you still do. But what the federal government said is that we're going to make the same rules for state banks. And you had states that said to banks, you can have one branch, but you can't have multiple branches. And you had states that said you can have multiple branches, but you can't have branches in other states. And the federal government came in and said, you can't make those rules. And suddenly you had multi-state banking corporations and you had holding companies. Same thing happened with electric utilities. In electric utilities, at the turn of the 20th century, 2,500 cities took over their electric distribution systems and generation systems. And still to this day, 2,000 cities own their own electric distribution systems. You don't need to own your own generation systems any longer because big power plants don't make sense any longer. But if you own your own distribution system, now suddenly you can make the rules that allow for rooftop solar. You can make the rules that allow for a decentralized generation. You can make the rules. Here in California, we have a big solar movement. And so lots of people have solar on their roof. However, I cannot sell my electricity across the street unless the utility company, in this case, Pacific Gas and Electric, gives me permission to do that. I can't cross the street. If I happen to be a university campus and it's contiguous that the university owns, I can do things between buildings on the university campus, but I can't cross the street. If you're a municipal electric utility, you can set the rules that say, sure, you can cross the street. Let's work together on this. You be the generators, you be the people who have the storage systems, and we, that is the utility company, will oversee it, and we will be in charge of the distribution system, and we will set that up. So it's a perfect place for one to have a utility, and there are 2,000 of them, as I say, you know, that are operating. It doesn't mean they're progressive, but it does mean that they are the structure that you would want to have if you want to decentralize the electricity generation system.
There's such a potential for corruption when you have all these little fiefdoms. Some of them might be progressive enough to say, let's allow this across the street and facilitate it. And there are others, I think, that either wouldn't have the capacity or the desire or, you know, their own initiative or interest in doing that.
That certainly is true. But the problem is that that also operates at above the city level. And so, and that's what was happening in the 19th century. The corporations, the business people, the railroad companies, you know, took over the state legislatures. And so if you wanted to do something at the local level, you couldn't. You simply didn't have the authority to do it. Now you might have a corrupt municipal government, but you can vote people out of office and you can have a corrupt electric utility. And you can't directly usually vote them out of office. They're not elected in that way, but they are appointed, you know, by the city. And so you can essentially influence them, you know, in those ways. Same thing in rural areas where you have rural electric cooperatives. And many people who are members of rural electric cooperatives would say, oh, geez, I don't have any control over my electric utility. But in fact, they do if they can get themselves organized to do it. So there's the potential, you know, in this case, you know, for doing it correctly. And we work at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We consider broadband to be basic infrastructure. And 20 years ago, we began working with cities about cities building their own, you know, broadband systems. And we found then, and we find now, that the vast majority of cities that built their own systems, out of the municipally owned electric utility company. And in rural areas, it was either your rural electric cooperatives or your rural telephone cooperatives, which were also, by the way, financed by FDR as part of his system of modernity, if you will, into rural areas. For municipalities, electric companies to get involved in broadband was a big step for them. You know, they're engineers, so you might say, well, you're engineers, you know how to do that. Well, yes, but broadband is a rapidly moving technological dynamic. It's customer-oriented service. You know, electric utilities is a matter of keeping the lines up and maintaining the system. You know, occasionally the customer will call you and say, I've got a problem, but it's a very different thing than broadband. And so you really did have to have entirely restructuring of the electric utility.
David, what are the benefits that you see of whether it's municipal electric systems authority or municipal authority over infrastructure? What are some of the benefits that could come with that?
Well, one big benefit is that you make the rules. It's not controversial that cities own the roads. Well, that means that the city gets to make the rules. Now, the state gets involved in that. The federal government gets involved in that a little bit. But essentially, the city makes the rules. If the city decides that there's going to be a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit, there's a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit, unless the state preempts their authority to do that. And the city, you know, can decide that it wants bike lanes, for example. The city makes the decision about sidewalks, whether you have to maintain the sidewalks and the like. So making the rules is, you know, is really, really very important, especially now when you're talking about micromobility and you're talking about bikes and you're talking about walking and you're talking about 15-minute cities. And I mean, so it's extraordinarily important. Imagine if you had the private sector that owned the roads. It would be a completely different dynamic that would occur. When it comes to the electric utilities, you know, then you're talking about, once again, being able to make the rules. But in that case, you're also talking about a technological revolution, the way you are with electric bikes, for example, and electric cars. But you're talking about a technological revolution that allows for decentralized generation of electricity and decentralized storage of electricity. And so, you know, that is something where utility companies know that and need to integrate that in some way, you know, into their system. And so that, you know, that allows them to essentially, you know, take that into account. The other thing is that when we do cost accounting, you know, when we say, is something a cost effective, the question is, what's in your equation for cost effective? Is it cost effective to the investor? Is it cost effective to the customer? Is it cost effective to the community? And one of the things about municipal ownership is that you can take into account the costs and benefits to the community as a whole. And in doing that, you probably will end up with different decisions than if you were simply a private sector that was making that decision. And that, I think, is probably the key, that you can think, you can put all the pieces together in your same decision-making process. You may come up with a decision I don't like, but on the other hand, you know, everybody, you know, you should do a full cost accounting.
The people in the city of Asheville have the voice or the leverage to impact or influence any of these things.
I do want to say something that's North Carolina specific, you know, which is that Wilson, North Carolina, set up its own broadband system, and it was very successful. And then one or two other cities in North Carolina set up their systems, and they were very successful. So the telecommunication companies went to the state legislature, and the state legislature stopped cities from doing that. So it's that, you know, you go from the electric utility to the broadband, and then suddenly you have preemption. Well, what happened from there is that under Obama, the federal government communications commission came in and did a rule that said essentially states cannot do that. States cannot preempt cities from stopping them from building electric utilities. And there was a law, the Telecommunications Act, that in fact can be interpreted that way, that came into effect in 1996. And so they essentially issued that rule. And interestingly enough, Republican senators, I think there were 20 of them, and representatives, I think there were also 20 or 30 of them, wrote a vehement letter of protest to the federal government. It says essentially, the federal government is so far away. The federal government has no idea what's going here. We are the representatives of the people. We are the government that's closest to the people. No, you're not the government closest to the people. City is the government closest to the people. The county is the government closest to the people. And what the federal government is trying to do is to protect the right of the actual people who are closest to the government that's going to make the decision to, in fact, make this decision, not people who are out there in the state legislatures that are often dominated by people who live in communities that are not the same.
If the government doesn't interfere with it, then the utilities, the major utilities, will lobby against it.
Well, that's what happened in North Carolina. That's what happened in Tennessee. That's what happened in Texas. That's what happened in Missouri. Everywhere in the country where cities began to build their broadband, the telecommunication companies, where there are 19 states right now, which don't ban, but put up barriers to cities essentially establishing their own broadband. And if you ask the telecommunication companies why they do that, they say, cities just don't know how to do this. Government couldn't possibly run this as efficiently as we. And the answer to that is, well, if they couldn't, then what's your problem?
Let's build on that. Maybe listening to this in Asheville or elsewhere, you can say, does my city to what degree do we have the ability to combat politicians who essentially are advocating for corporations to make these decisions, which are not always in the best interest of the community?
Well, let's take the issue of big box retail, which seems ancient history now that we have Amazon, right? But nevertheless, it wasn't that long ago, right? That for many people, the problem was big box, you know, primarily Walmart is what we're talking about as it began to come into cities. And the question was, what do you do about it? And cities began to impose regulations that either limited the height or the size of big box, or actually in effect banned them. But the question is, did the city have the authority to do that? And the big box corporations went to the courts and said, they can't do this because that's an interstate commerce issue. Cities don't have control over that. They're stopping us from moving and flowing goods and commerce and so forth. And the court said, in this instance, cities have the right to control land use and they have the police power. And this falls under those forms of authority. And so they do, in fact, have the right to regulate here. And you began to have cities that introduced what are called formula regulations. It started with restaurants, where the city said, if you're McDonald's, you can come in here and you can set up a franchise, a restaurant. However, that restaurant cannot be a formula restaurant, meaning that it cannot have the same silverware, the same this, the same this, the same this. It can't have that. Otherwise, you want to come in and not call yourself a McDonald's and not have a big arch and not have the same menu, you can do that. But of course, McDonald's says, well, wait a minute, you know, we can't do that. And so you're in effect banning chain stores. And so you had the authority to do that. In many cases, the cities might not have the authority. But if you wanted to think about this, and I hope that people can think about this in this way, which is, do an inventory of what the city has as a resource. Start with the resource. For example, the city owns buildings. You know, right now, buildings could generate all of their electricity. So what does that mean? Cities own land. Can that land be used for affordable housing? The cities have an enormous amount of debt capacity. They are under statute, as are states, by the way, in terms of how much debt that you can take on. But nevertheless, the cities, on behalf of all of us, can borrow a lot of money. And so the question then becomes, well, how much money could a city leverage? And you think, well, is there something in my city that cost an awful lot of money that the city used its financing capacity to generate capital for? And the answer in many places is, there's a sports stadium. There's a convention center. Wait a minute. And so you find out, yes, indeed. And these things might cost $50 million. They might cost $200 million. They might cost $500 million, right? And so if you want to do something like affordable housing someplace in the city, on city-owned land, and says, we can't afford that. You say, whoa. We don't want anything more than the financing that built that monstrosity over there. That's all. We're not asking for anything more than that. So you do have the capacity to do that. Now, that's oversimplified, but nevertheless, it does indicate how people might want to think about, you know, what their resources, you know, are. Cities own their own water utilities, almost all cities, although not all cities, and a number of cities have, in fact, given up control of their water utility. But nevertheless, most cities own their own water utility. Water utility is important for a lot of different reasons, but the flow of water, there's pressure attached to the flow of water. Water has heat in it, even though you might think it's cold when it comes out of the tap. And you can tap into both of those things to generate energy. And so there are now water utilities that are beginning to look at how they can extract energy out of the flow of water through their pipes. And so think of that, you know, what is it that the city has that might be useful in terms of generating wealth? That's different from the city making the rules. So the city making the rules is to me more important, but more challenging. The city having the ability to do something is easier to do, but we don't normally think of the city as being able to do that.
So why are cities challenged? It feels like municipalities, if they understand their capabilities, their natural assets and things like that, should know what their bargaining chips are And it feels like when it comes to doing things that are the best for all people, it seems like they fall apart. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But it seems to me when it comes to whether it's development or energy or cable or any of these other things, it seems like they're more willing to give out incentives to different companies and organizations than they are to implement sticks to actually penalize them for doing certain things.
Yes, that's true. That's true. It's a good point. You know, we prefer the carrots because the carrots are easy. Everybody loves carrots, except for the people who have to pay higher taxes because of it. But nevertheless, you know, people like carrots. Sticks are problematic. But when it comes to development, whenever you read in the paper that someone built a apartment building, you invariably find out that they got a, quote, variance from the zoning law, meaning that they built it higher than the zoning would have them build it. And the zoning is based on a master plan. And the master plan, often in cities, came out of many years of discussion about, you know, what do we want the city to look like, and what do we want the density to be, and so on and so forth. And out of that came a master plan, and out of that came zoning, which are the specific rules around, you know, different pieces, you know, of the land that a city has. So when you go into a planning commission and you say, I want to build a 10-story building, and the zoning is for a 5-story building, you have to ask for permission to do that. And often cities think of that as, well, yeah, that, okay, fine. You know, so if the neighbors are upset, how about if you set it back a little bit? Or maybe you can plant some trees, you know, or maybe if worse comes to worse, how about an 8-story building rather than a 10-story building, right? Exactly. But the point is that you don't have to do that. Essentially, what they're doing is they're asking permission to violate the rules that were developed through a process. This isn't a process. This is somebody coming in and saying, I want to violate the rules. And then they give them permission to do that. And so there is leverage. You know, I often tell the story of how I was talking to somebody who is the head of planning in Santa Monica, but had previously been the head of planning in Winooski, Vermont. And I said to him, what's the difference between how you handle things in Winooski as opposed to how you handle things in Santa Monica? And he said, well, here's the situation. He says, in Santa Monica, if a developer comes and wants to build something, I say, well, okay, that sounds interesting. We want a daycare center. You know, we want this, we want this, we want this, we want this, we want this. You can ask for anything. In Winooski, if someone says, I want to build a this, you go, you want our firstborn or our firstborn and our secondborn. And that's the difference between having leverage and not having leverage. Yeah. And the thing about cities is that virtually all of them say, we have no leverage. And my feeling is, why don't you think of yourselves as the private sector for a minute? Put your private sector hat on. Your private sector hat says, we're going to ask for as much as we can to the point at which the other party walks away, at which point we realize we've asked for too much. Well, you're a city. You're going to be around for a very long time. And so ask for too much, or say no, or do something that indicates that a process is going on here, right? And you will find out over time about how much you could get and how much you can't get, right?
The funny thing about that, David, is that that's what corporations do. If you're in business, you're going in with your best case scenario and having someone push you away from it. I think that's great advice. What are some of the examples you've seen of cities being successful in building out capabilities that are in the best interests of all of its citizens?
Well, let me give you a couple of examples. One is from St. Paul, and I worked in St. Paul in 1980-81, the mayor of St. Paul and I would be sharing speaking platforms in various places because we were both talking about energy. And he asked me to lunch one day. He was in D.C. And he said, you know, you talk a good talk here. Can you walk the walk? And I said, yeah, I think so. I sure think so. So he invited me out to St. Paul and grilled me for 3 hours on how local self-reliance might be relevant to what was going on in St. Paul. And it's a long story as to that conversation. Out of that grew what they called the homegrown economy, which was a program that was established starting in 1983, which was, how do we get the most from our local resources? essentially. Let's think of the city from the inside out as opposed from the outside in. And that was a moment where all the cities in the country, including states, were vying for General Motors' new automobile plant. And they were giving to the left, to the right, and the left, to the right. It's a little like Amazon now with their, you know, with their new headquarters. And of course, Detroit won. And of course, they didn't build it. But they did rip down an entire neighborhood called Poletown before they got around to not building it. But that's not really the point. The point is that we were trying to say to the city, you got small businesses, you got independent businesses, you got bigger businesses and smaller businesses, but the bigger businesses were born here. And the people and the owners of them live here. And so when they pay local taxes, their kids go to the schools. So why don't we focus on independent businesses? And why don't we think, what do we have here as terms of resources? And the city looked and said, well, we have a downtown, which was relatively small. I mean, you know, maybe 15 square blocks. And what we'd like to do is to set up a district energy system. There was no district energy system at that point. And they did. They set up a district energy system. That was one of the projects coming out of the homegrown economy. And the first thing they had to do was to confront the utility, because the utility, which was an electric utility and a gas utility, the gas had the franchise for providing gas, which would then provide heat to the downtown buildings and cooling. And that took about 2 or 3 years to essentially get permission from the state regulatory utility commission for them to build that system. And they did. And so in 1983, they imported somebody from Sweden who had a hot water system, which was much more efficient than the steam systems, which were in existence in the United States. And they built a district energy system. And interestingly enough, the foundations came in to help, but they didn't help by giving money to the building of the system. What they did is they gave money as a backup so that the district energy system could go to the owners of the buildings and say, you will never have to pay more for the heat that we're supplying you than you were paying previously for the heat that came from the natural gas that you were burning. So they held them harmless. That is the new customers that they were trying to attract. Well, 5 years later, the price of natural gas collapsed. And so essentially that backup was necessary, but then it went back up. So over the long term, the owners of the buildings, you know, made out like bandits, frankly. Well, 10 years after district heating started, district cooling started, because we were phasing out chlorofluorocarbons. And so for the cooling systems of apartments, when they had to change over, we put a 400% tax on chlorofluorocarbons. And so it was very expensive for them to do that. So we added cooling. And then 10 years after that, we added electricity that was generated by the tree clippings from the Twin Cities area that were collected and then chipped. And then provided the electricity. And now, literally now, right? So we're talking 30, almost 40 years later, they are setting up a cogeneration system, which means a engine that's going to generate heat and electricity. And the fuel is going to be hydrogen right now. And the district energy system is now provides assistance to cities all around the country and all around the world. I mean, they could come into Asheville, you know, and say, well, let's take a look at this and what you might do there, right? But that's 40 years of development and experience that started when the city said, let's look at ourselves differently here. And the district energy system, by the way, is some of the board of directors are appointed by the mayor. Most of the board of directors are elected by the individual categories of building owners. Let me give you one other example. Now, this example is one that people guys say, oh, well, that's, you know, you can, whenever you give an example, people say, oh, that's California, right? Or, oh my God, no, that's, you know, Boston or something like that. Well, in this case, I'm talking about Saskatchewan, and I'm talking about Saskatchewan in 1920. Uh-huh. You know, very rural province, you know, sparsely populated province. And people got together and pooled their income to hire, import a doctor. And then they pooled their income to build a little local hospital. And then the people of Saskatchewan voted into office a new political party called the Cooperative Commonwealth Confederation, a coalition. And they introduced health insurance for hospitals. And so that was the beginning of what eventually became national health insurance in Canada. And in the late 1940s, early 1950s, other provinces adopted health insurance for hospitals. And the federal government came in and said, this makes sense. We're going to finance 50% of your costs of doing that, because that makes sense to us. And Saskatchewan said, had the same head of Saskatchewan at that point, said, you know, the reason we didn't do doctors as well as hospitals is we couldn't afford it back there. But if you're going to pay half the cost of the hospitals, we're going to expand to doctors. And I think it was 1957 and 1958, they said, okay, doctors are now covered. And the doctors of Saskatchewan went on strike. And the strike lasted for about 3 or 4 days. And then it was broken. And 6 months later, 8 months later, the opposition party was elected. And part of the platform they were running on was essentially getting rid of this thing, that this socialist communist thing that had been imposed on the people of Saskatchewan. And it was elected and it was in office. And they have a parliamentary system up there, you know. So if you're elected, you essentially can do what you want to do. And that party found out that it couldn't reverse history, because the citizens of Saskatchewan had lived for 30 years under hospital health insurance and were doing very well by it, and then had been living for a relatively short time, less than a year, under doctor health insurance, but thought that was a great idea and weren't about to allow that, you know, to be undone. And then the next step was in the 1960s, when the federal government of Canada introduced what was called, in 1965 or 67, it was Medicare. So believe it or not, Medicare in the United States came in at just about the same time that Medicare came in Canada. But Medicare in the United States came in from the top down, and Medicare in Canada came in from the bottom up. And so in Canada, they don't have national health insurance, they have provincial health insurance, where the Canadian government, if you abide by certain principles at the provincial level, like it's portable, it can be used in different provinces, it covers everyone, that they will pay 50% of the costs. So you have a very decentralized system, and some of those provinces, for example, the province of Saskatchewan now, is a third the size of New York City. So you're talking about, you know, systems that work. And that worked because of what happened in one small little province, and then over time it was included. And just one other thing on this was that when they put in the insurance, you immediately began to have a two-tier system where people who paid, you know, people could have their own suite, their own private room, and so forth. And the Canadians were horrified at that. And in 1980, they put in the law that said there will be no two-tiered system in Canada. If you use the health insurance, you don't get yourself a private room if somebody else doesn't have a private room too. That is, once you had that system within public hands, the public got to make the rules.
David, one of the questions that comes to mind is, we've talked about all the different aspects that a local government could impact. We've talked about energy, we've talked about commercial buildings, we've talked a little bit about development, telecommunications, now healthcare. We talked about most recently this idea of forming a local political party to actually expand access to healthcare. So given today's political climate, do you feel like this is possible today in some of our cities? And if so, how might that happen?
I think it's possible in some of our cities and in some of our states. North Carolina is a particularly tough nut to crack there, because your state is still in the process of preempting local authority. And, you know, when Obamacare was passed, the federal government said, we will pay 100% of the costs of expanding your Medicaid so that it was beyond, so the income level to qualify was higher and you could have single people that could be, you know, single men who could be qualified. 100%. And half the states in the country said, no siree, Bob, right? And North Carolina was one of those. What?
Not because it made sense, because of this partisan politics that I feel like, not just in North Carolina, but in so many places, it's almost like no matter what you want. You're the enemy. I don't want it. And I'm going to do anything to prevent you from doing what you want.
Well, no, that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And then the pandemic happened. And with the pandemic, everybody agreed in Congress that they're going to expand Medicaid and the federal government would pay for it. Well, the crisis is over and states have now have the ability to, in fact, go back. And every state is making their own decision about what to do about this. Well, North Carolina doesn't have to make a decision because they never expanded it. But in a number of different states that didn't expand it, and or that did expand it just a little bit, they now have Medicaid and they're taking it away, which is different from giving it. People who haven't had it don't know what it's like. But people who have it and it's now being taken away from them is a different dynamic. And so you're having a discussion go on in red states now about the million people in some of their states, like Texas, that are having their medical insurance taken away from them. Because you could call it partisan politics, if you will, but I don't really want to raise it to that level because someone has to explain to me why it is that we wouldn't permit, you know, healthcare. I lived on a farm in the 1970s in a rural Maryland in a place that's quite conservative, although 1970 quite conservative is different from 2023 quite conservative. And the conservatives didn't believe that you should give, if people were lazy, then that was their problem. You shouldn't have to take care of people who are lazy. And they probably would say, or people who don't look like us, right? Or people who don't speak English really well, right? But when it came to medical care, they thought everybody had the right or should have the right to medical care. It was interesting. And it was revelatory to me that we treated that differently than anything else. Well, in the United States, we actually don't treat that differently from anybody else. And in the Medicare Medicaid, you know, situation right now, it should be, in fact, to me, one of the centerpieces of any political discussion and any political election that we have. Why is it that you will not allow me or my neighbor or my community to have access to healthcare when it will cost you virtually nothing?
Let's just say I really want to make sure that my elected representative, my municipal leaders here are aware of the power they have, or maybe need some help getting access to that leverage or realizing what it is they have. What would this specific recommendation be?
Well, one of the things about the Institute for Local Self-Reliance is that we have a website and it is astonishingly content rich. You have to search for something that tells you about us, right? But you don't have to search for anything that tells you about what you can do and what you should do and what people are doing and what other cities are doing and so forth. So it is easy. It is ILSR, as if it were I Love Self-Reliance, ILSR.org. Take a look at that. And through that, you can get to me too, so that, you know, we can have a conversation about that, you know, as well. We don't have all the answers, but we do know what the questions are. And we do know the people who are responding to those questions and who's doing things well, and also those barriers that people have to overcome and how they've overcome those barriers.
So, David, thank you very much for being on the show today. I think it's very, very helpful. I think a lot of the things that you've talked about are opening the eyes to folks that if we want change, it has to happen at a local level, because a lot of the things that you've been talking about, energy, buildings, healthcare, are all things that affect people locally. It seems like it might be possible to push our local governments to act more than we might think that they can, or even they think they can. Is that a fair kind of assessment?
I think so. You know, absolutely. I mean, the locality is, you know, as they say, it's where the rubber meets the road. I mean, you know, mayors get thrown out of office. Well, in the North, mayors get thrown out of office because the snow wasn't plowed, right?
Right.
These are the national issues are often local issues writ large, except when it comes to foreign policy. But right. Otherwise, you know, everything that goes on in Washington affects you as an individual, your household, your neighborhood, and your city, and that is where the rules that they make, or the money that they appropriate, has its impact.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Really appreciate the time today, David Habanero. As always, thank you very much. Have a good day, everybody.
Take care.